content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're reading this week from the April 13th, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The front cover drawing this week is almost entirely in red. It looks like a red map of the states. You can see Arkansas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, Iowa. There's a old beat-up looking plaid couch, and standing in the foreground is a cartoon drawing of Roseanne Barr with one hand on her hip and the other hand in the air waving, and she's smiling. The title says, Discovering Trump Land, What Roseanne's Return Reveals About TV, Politics, and America. I think that article is the controversy of the week, but as usual, we'll start with the main stories and how they were covered. Trump orders the guard to the border. What happened? Frustrated by his inability to get funding for his border wall, President Trump threatened this week to take tough action against illegal immigration, directing states to put National Guard troops on the southwestern border and declaring efforts to protect young undocumented immigrants dead. Trump vented his anger on Twitter over the course of 3 days with a series of tweets blaming Democrats and the Mexican government for a massive inflow of drugs and people into the U.S. In particular, the president pointed to the threat posed by a caravan of about 1,200 Central Americans headed north through Mexico, who Trump claimed went to take advantage of DACA protections, even though the program is in limbo and new immigrants wouldn't qualify anyway. Border Patrol agents are not allowed to properly do their job at the border because of ridiculous liberal Democrat laws, Trump tweeted. No more DACA deal. Trump later told reporters that he wanted the U.S. military to guard the U.S. border until the massive wall he promised during the presidential campaign could be built. The Posse Comitatus Act bars the military from civil law enforcement on U.S. soil without approval from Congress, but the National Guard can provide support services. The White House says Guard units will conduct air and camera surveillance of the border, but will not have direct contact with migrants. Until we can have a wall and proper security, we're going to be guarding our border with the military, Trump said. That's a big step. What the editorial said, Trump's unhinged immigration tweet storm is fact-free fear-mongering, said the Washington Post. Illegal immigration at the southwestern border is the lowest it's been since 1971 and has been falling for years thanks to an improved Mexican economy and beefed up U.S. security. Border Patrol arrests, the best measure of illegal immigration flows, fell from 700,000 to 409,000 a year under President Obama and have already dropped to 304,000 under President Trump. Trump's fever dream of a porous border overrun with drug runners and criminals simply doesn't exist. Trump's dreaded caravan is also an invented crisis, said the Los Angeles Times. It's an annual protest staged by the activist group People Without Borders to draw attention to people fleeing violence in countries like Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Some of the 1,200 people involved will attempt to seek asylum in the U.S., which the U.S. government can deny, but many have already been given visas to stay in Mexico. The Border Patrol apprehended 37,000 people at the border in February, so the numbers involved aren't frightening. That's still way too many people, said the WashingtonExaminer.com. A country without borders, Trump repeatedly says, is no country at all. That's true, and we should do what it takes to enforce our laws. What the columnist said, looks like President Fox News' grandpa saw something on television again, said Jack Holmes and Esquire.com. Trump's favorite cable news network has been running frantic coverage of the immigrant caravan, triggering his tweet storm. But Trump isn't totally addled. He knows his most ardent supporters feel let down by his inability to get funding for his big, beautiful wall in the recent budget bill. So he's trying to reassure them he still hates immigrants. That caravan of migrants marching toward the U.S. border is not imaginary, said John Daniel Davidson in TheFederalist.com, and Trump is smart to seize on it. Even if these people are denied asylum, the law requires them to be detained while their requests are considered, and many will eventually be released into the U.S. When will Democrats opposed to real immigration reform admit they want open borders, mass immigration, and amnesty? If Trump were serious about border security, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, he would have taken Democrats' offer to fund his wall in exchange for enshrining DACA protections in law. But Trump couldn't take yes for an answer, and piled on deal-breaker demands like major cuts to legal immigration. As long as there's no wall, he can rail against brown invaders to rile up his white base. His antipathy toward Latinos and non-whites is genuine, I trust, but his wall is pure counterfeit. And as promised, the controversy of the week is the new Roseanne, paying attention to Trump's America. If Hollywood truly cared about diversity, said Kyle Smith in NYPost.com, it would be wise to take note of the largest minority it's currently ignoring, Trump voters. Last week, after a 21-year hiatus, the show Roseanne returned to a monster audience of more than 18 million and a daring message. Trump supporters are human. The reborn show reunites Roseanne Barr and John Goodman as Roseanne and Dan Connor, heads of a big, messy, blue-collar family in the Illinois Rust Belt, still squabbling, loving each other, and trying to make ends meet. But something has changed. Once an obvious Democrat, Barr's titular character has morphed, like Barr herself, into a passionate supporter of President Trump, who, she explains, talks about jobs and promised to shake things up. With wit and humor, she trades insults with her sister, Jackie, Laurie Metcalf, a liberal Democrat who finds Trump horrifying. The show's instant popularity holds a lesson for TV producers, said the Washington Times in an editorial. Rather than cater solely to coastal elites, maybe they might make a few shows for the deplorables in flyover country, working class people who elected a president that Hollywood doesn't approve of. Naturally, our notoriously ratings-obsessed president took Roseanne's success as a personal triumph, said Will Bunch in Philly.com. Trump called Barr to congratulate her and later bragged to a rally that the show is about us. But is it really? The Connors now have a black granddaughter and a gender-fluid grandson, both of whom they treat with love and compassion. If the goal is to give an honest portrayal of Trump's America, the Connors should have Fox News blaring all day long and spend each episode spewing venom about illegal immigrants, Muslims, ungrateful blacks, and transgender soldiers. by filtering out the most toxic elements of Trumpism, said Roxane Gay in the New York Times. Roseanne ends up just normalizing Trump and his warped, harmful political ideologies. The show also normalizes Roseanne Barr herself, said Bob Sheffield in RollingStone.com. Once upon a time, Barr, now 65, was the most abrasively left-wing presence on network TV, an unapologetic champion of every woman trying to keep a home and a family together in post-industrial America. Since leaving our screens, Barr has swerved right with a vengeance. The new Roseanne can often be found spouting off on Twitter, said Dan Fishback in Esquire.com, calling Clinton aide Huma Abedin a filthy Nazi whore and peddling lunatic conspiracy theories from the far-right fever swamps. Just this week, she tweeted that Trump has freed so many children held in bondage to pimps, a claim stemming from the hashtag Pizzagate conspiracy theory that leading Democrats, including Hillary Clinton, are running a global pedophile ring. Lots of other actors say nutty things, said Gary Abernathy in the Washington Post. Look, Roseanne may be a Trump supporter, but the show is not highly partisan and does a good job representing various points of view, including her liberal sisters. For the show to reach its potential, it should seek to do what All in the Family did in the early 1970s. Archie Bunker, the bigoted Richard Nixon supporter, and his liberal son-in-law Mike start out hating each other, but over time they both evolve, become less extreme, and eventually understand and respect each other. If the new Roseanne is skillfully written, sometimes Roseanne's point of view will make Jackie stop and think, and Jackie's opinions will occasionally give Roseanne cause for reflection. Wouldn't that be a refreshing change? It was a good week for 10-mile runs. After the Army said it may extend basic training by 2 weeks to cope with an influx of flabby, unfit recruits. Officials say the recruits were so out of shape and undisciplined that trainers and dietitians might be posted to active units abroad. It was a good week for Lou Dobbs with the news that President Trump is so enamored of the firebrand populist Fox Business cable star that he patches him through on speakerphone to meetings of cabinet members and senior aides. Trump cherishes Lou, said a White House official. It was a good week for manual transmission after two Florida boys, ages 12 and 14, tried to steal a Domino's truck while the driver was delivering a pizza, only to be foiled by their lack of stick shift experience. When they go back to get the first gear, they cannot drive, recounted driver Javier Ortiz. But it was a bad week for Parrish, Alabama, where a trainload of 10 million pounds of sewage sludge from New York City has been stalled for the past 6 weeks as a legal battle rages over where it will wind up, filling the town with an overpowering stench. We didn't produce it, said Mayor Heather Hall. We don't want it here. It was a bad week for diversity, with the release of the official spring 2018 White House intern photograph. Of the 91 interns posing with a beaming President Trump, only three appear to be non-white. And it was a bad week for Kellyanne Conway, after author Ronald Kessler claimed the senior aide is the number one leaker in the White House. In one recent interview for his pro-Trump book, Kessler said Conway forgot she was on the record and lit into Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. And while we're here, a boring but important item. Obama-era fuel standards reversed. The Environmental Protection Agency moved this week to roll back strict emissions standards for automakers that were put in place during the Obama administration. Regulations require new cars and trucks sold in the U.S. to average more than 50 miles per gallon by 2025 in order to reduce the industry's carbon footprint. Those standards are inappropriate and should be revised, EPA Director Scott Pruitt said in his announcement, describing the existing requirements as too draconian. Pruitt did not say what the new standards might eventually be. The U.S. auto fleet for model year 2017 averaged 31.8 miles per gallon. The 38-page document explaining the EPA's rationale for rewriting the existing rules does not mention climate change. The title of our briefing page article this week is The Long Shadow of the Financial Crisis. It's been 10 years since the global economy nearly collapsed. Could it happen again? What caused the crisis? The bursting of the U.S. housing bubble triggered a chain reaction that nearly brought down the global financial system. Between 1997 and 2006, a combination of low interest rates, relaxed lending regulations, and government policies designed to encourage home buying fueled a housing boom that saw the average price for a U.S. home increase by 124%. Amid the speculative frenzy, financial institutions issued hundreds of billions of dollars in questionable loans to so-called subprime borrowers with poor credit histories. Borrowers' ability to repay didn't matter to lenders because they were able to get subprime mortgages off their books by repackaging them into wildly complex derivative financial instruments like mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations. Corporate and institutional investors gobbled up these offerings, which not only offered attractive returns, but also received high safety ratings from the major credit rating agencies. In 2007 and 2008, the inevitable wave of foreclosures finally arrived, exposing the entire financial system to catastrophic losses. Then what happened? The worst financial panic since the Great Depression. Already dangerously overleveraged from years of risky bets, banks were unable to absorb the huge losses. The first big domino to fall was the investment bank Bear Stearns, which collapsed in March 2008. Later, Lehman Brothers filed for the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history. And the government bailed out insurance giant AIG, which had sold enormous amounts of credit default swap, ensuring the bad investments. As panic spread, lending and investments screeched to a halt, and the country was plunged into the worst financial crisis since the stock market collapse of 1929. How did the government respond? The U.S. government took extraordinary measures to prevent a full-scale economic collapse. Under President George W. Bush, Congress approved a $700 billion bailout, purchasing toxic assets to restore confidence in the market. Under President Barack Obama, it authorized a $787 billion stimulus package to stimulate spending in the private sector. But massive damage had already been done. The economy slipped into a deep recession. The Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 lost more than half their value. Unemployment peaked at roughly 10% by October 2009. Is the system safer now? In many ways, yes. Obama signed a series of sweeping financial reforms known as the Dodd-Frank Act. Among other things, it required banks to carry bigger capital cushions to protect against future crises, with regular stress tests to assess their ability to withstand a severe economic downturn. In 2017, the Federal Reserve judged that all 34 of the financial institutions deemed systemically important by Dodd-Frank would be able to keep lending in a crisis similar to 2008's. Dodd-Frank also put greater restrictions on trading derivatives such as credit default swaps, which were virtually unregulated before the crisis, but not everyone is satisfied. This is not an industry that has examined itself and remade itself in the wake of the crisis, said Phil Angelides, who chaired the U.S. government's official investigation into the causes of the crisis. What hasn't changed? Bank consolidation, for one. More than 20 of the 30 banks that are still considered too big to fail are significantly larger than they were 10 years ago, including J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America. The Senate recently passed a bipartisan bill rolling back parts of Dodd-Frank that lawmakers believe unfairly burden smaller banks, although some critics say larger banks could exploit loopholes in the proposed rules. Meanwhile, Wall Street hasn't lost its appetite for risk. In 2012, a single trader at J.P. Morgan, nicknamed the London Whale, created $6.2 billion in losses through enormously risky bets involving credit default swaps. New breeds of exotic financial products have also emerged, including exchange-traded funds that allow investors to bet on everything from cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin to market volatility. Is another crisis possible? The same kind of collapse isn't likely. Banks are no longer saddled with a massive amount of subprime housing debt. But if a different kind of debt crisis does emerge, the lingering damage from the last crisis has left the government ill-prepared to confront it. The Federal Reserve has only begun to raise interest rates again after cutting them to near zero during the recession. It could be years before they return to pre-crisis levels, leaving the central bank with few tools to stimulate the economy in another crisis. Congress and the president will also be hard-pressed to respond. Although the Wall Street bailouts eventually were paid back, they were so politically toxic that it's hard to imagine another round of them. The biggest regret I've got is that life is going to be much more difficult for any regulator sitting in the seats facing another crisis, because what we did was so unpopular, said Hank Paulson, who was Secretary of the Treasury under George W. Bush. I stand guilty of not being able to explain why the financial system was good for Americans. The recession's lingering scars. The economy appears to be booming again, with unemployment hovering just above 4% and corporate profits at record highs. But the recovery hasn't been distributed evenly. The government's rush to prop up failing markets primarily benefited wealthy Americans, who own most of the country's stocks and other assets, while many workers who lost homes and jobs in the crisis saw their income take a permanent hit. More than a million workers were knocked out of the labor force altogether and still haven't returned. The top 10% of Americans have seen their share of the country's wealth increase from 71% before the crisis to 77% today, while the bottom 90% suffered a corresponding decrease. The median lower-income household now has just $10,800 in assets, down almost $8,000. The average effects of a recession are severe and very long-lasting, said Jeannie Brand, a sociologist at the University of California, Los Angeles. There's no quick recovery. Thank you. Time now for a few of the week's best columns. These first two come from the U.S. Sinclair's State Propaganda. Sinclair Broadcasting wants its 173 local TV stations to parrot its conservative pro-Trump views, said Eric Wimple. To guarantee partisan uniformity, Sinclair, run by a family of wealthy Republican donors, regularly issues dictates to the stations, including a script it recently demanded that local anchors read on the air. Ironically, the script decries the troubling trend of irresponsible, one-sided news stories and fake stories, and claims that other media try to control exactly what people think. The website Deadspin this week put together a chilling video of dozens of anchors robotically reading the same words as if reciting state propaganda. Sinclair also mandates that stations run political analysis from former Trump advisor Boris Epstein, who echoes White House talking points. Naturally, President Trump tweeted his endorsement of Sinclair, saying it is far superior to CNN and other fake news networks. Not incidentally, Sinclair is currently seeking federal approval to buy most of Tribune Media's 42 TV stations, which would give the company more than 200 stations and access to 72% of U.S. households. Would Sinclair's unabashed support of the president perhaps influence his administration's decision? To even ask that question, of course, is to be guilty of fake news. How to raise confident children. We shouldn't have to clarify that it's legal to let kids play without adult supervision, said Lenore Skenazy. But Utah just became the first state in the nation to pass a free-range parenting law, which says parents can't be arrested for letting well-cared-for children go to the park by themselves, bike to school, or briefly stay at home alone. It seems crazy, but such arrests have occurred with increasing frequency. These days, people believe that unsupervised kids are automatically in danger, even though the crime rate is much lower now than when today's adults were growing up. One explanation is a 24/7 news media that thrives on fear and bad news, making rare tragedies seem commonplace. But the biggest factor is the illusion of control parents have gotten from technology. Before smartphones, parents accepted that when kids went out the door, they were on their own and out of touch. Now, anytime you aren't monitoring their every move, you are making a conscious decision to opt out of your role as omniscient protector. That creates fear and guilt. To make your children safe, make them street smart. Teach them how to cross the road safely and how to respond to creepy strangers. A child can't grow up in a cocoon. This column comes from Italy with an interesting title. The eggplant that gummed up the courts. Italy's legal system is creaking at the seams, said Gian Antonio Stella, largely because our courts are clogged with absurdly trivial cases. In the southern region of Puglia, for example, a man has just been acquitted for stealing a single eggplant from a field after a 9-year legal battle that cost taxpayers about $9,000. Police caught the jobless suspect leaving the field with the offending a vegetable in a bucket in 2009. He claimed he'd only taken it to feed his starving family, and the farmer didn't press charges. Yet he was still prosecuted, sentenced to 5 months in jail and fined about $600, penalties that were reduced on appeal. His lawyer, incensed at the unfairness of it all, lodged the case at the Supreme Court in Rome, where it languished for years, until the justices finally threw it out. The court has accumulated a backlog of more than 100,000 of such crazy cases. Most are domestic spats, like the man who sued his daughter-in-law for serving him shop-bought rather than homemade pasta, or disputes between neighbors over such petty things as wet laundry dripping onto the balcony below. No one wants arbitrary limits on court time, but is it really so hard to distinguish between important cases of principle and those that just waste time and money? And finally, one from South Korea, the dangers of a graying nation. The most pressing threat facing South Korea today is not war with our northern neighbor, said Lee Jong-hwa. It's demographics. People talk of Japan as an ultra-aged society, but South Korea is going the same way fast and is not nearly as well prepared to deal with it. The country's fertility rate, the number of babies a woman is expected to have in her lifetime, is now a mere 1.05 births per woman, one of the lowest in the world. When South Korean baby boomers hit retirement age in 2030, nearly one-third of the population will be age 65 or over, similar to Japan's today. Already we're seeing a rapid decline in daycare centers for children and a matching increase in the number of nursing homes for the elderly. It's time to act to ameliorate the effects of this dangerous demographic shift. Japan can offer guidance. The nation introduced reforms to make workplaces both more family-friendly and more open to senior citizens. It assigned a minister to the specific job of keeping the population above the 100 million mark. These efforts have paid off. Japan's fertility rate has risen from 1.26 in 2005 to 1.44 last year. South Korea should follow suit without delay. We can't wait until it's too late to respond to an aged society. Time for the last word, our in-depth feature article. Title this week, Why You Forget Most of What You Read. The forgetting curve is steepest in the first 24 hours after you learn something, said writer Julie Beck. But in the internet age, memories seem to flee our minds much faster. Pamela Paul's memories of reading are less about words and more about the experience. I almost always remember where I was, and I remember the book itself. I remember the physical object, says Paul, the editor of the New York Times Book Review, who reads, it is fair to say, a lot of books. I remember the edition. I remember the cover. I usually remember where I bought it or who gave it to me. What I don't remember, and it's terrible, is everything else. For example, Paul told me she recently finished reading Walter Isaacson's biography of Benjamin Franklin. While I read that book, I knew not everything there was to know about Ben Franklin, but much of it. And I knew the general timeline of the American Revolution, she says. Right now, 2 days later, I probably could not give you the timeline of the American Revolution. Surely some people can read a book or watch a movie once and retain the plot perfectly, but for many, the experience of consuming culture is like filling up a bathtub, soaking in it, and then watching the water run down the drain. It might leave a film in the tub, but the rest is gone. Memory generally has a very intrinsic limitation, said Faria Sana, an assistant professor of psychology at Athabasca University in Canada. It's essentially a bottleneck. The forgetting curve, as it's called, is steepest during the first 24 hours after you learn something. Exactly how much you forget, percentage-wise, varies, but unless you review the material, much of it slips down the drain after the first day, with more to follow in the days after, leaving you with a fraction of what you took in. Presumably, memory has always been like this. But Jared Horvath, a research fellow at the University of Melbourne, says that the way people now consume information and entertainment has changed what type of memory we value. And it's not the kind that helps you hold on to the plot of a movie you saw 6 months ago. In the internet age, recall memory, the ability to spontaneously call information up in your mind, has become less necessary. It's still good for bar trivia or remembering your to-do list, but largely, Horvath says, what's called recognition memory is more important. So long as you know where that information is and how to access it, then you don't really need to recall it, he says. Research has shown that the internet functions as a sort of externalized memory. When people expect to have future access to information, they have lower rates of recall of the information itself, as one study puts it. But even before the internet existed, entertainment products served as externalized memories for themselves. You don't need to remember a quote from a book if you can just look it up. Once videotapes came along, you could review a movie or TV show fairly easily. There's not a sense that if you don't burn a piece of culture into your brain, it will be lost forever. With its streaming services and Wikipedia articles, the internet has lowered the stakes on remembering the culture we consume even further. But it's hardly as if we remembered it all before. Plato was a famous early curmudgeon when it came to the dangers of externalizing memory. In the dialogue Plato wrote between Socrates and the aristocrat Phaedrus, Socrates tells a story about the god Thuth discovering the use of letters. The Egyptian king Thamus says to Thuth, "This discovery of yours will create forgetfulness in the learner's souls, because they will not use their memories. They will trust to the external written characters and not remember of themselves." Of course, Plato's ideas are only accessible to us today because he wrote them down. In the dialogue, Socrates hates writing because he thinks it's going to kill memory, Horvath says. And he's right. Writing absolutely killed memory. But think of all the incredible things we got because of writing. I wouldn't trade writing for a better recall memory, ever. Perhaps the internet offers a similar trade-off. You can access and consume as much information and entertainment as you want, but you won't retain most of it. It's true that people often shove more into their brains than they can possibly hold. Last year, Horvath and his colleagues at the University of Melbourne found that those who binge-watched TV shows forgot the content of them much more quickly than people who watched one episode a week. Right after finishing the show, the binge watcher scored the highest on a quiz about it. But after 140 days, they scored lower than the weekly viewers. They also reported enjoying the show less than did people who watched it once a day or weekly. People are binging on the written word, too. In 2009, the average American encountered 100,000 words a day, even if they didn't read all of them. It's hard to imagine that's decreased in the 9 years since then. In Binge Reading Disorder, an article for the independent web magazine The Morning News, Nikita Bakshani analyzes the meaning of this statistic. Reading is a nuanced word, she writes, but the most common kind of reading is likely reading as consumption, where we read, especially on the internet, merely to acquire information. Information that stands no chance of becoming knowledge unless it sticks. Or as Horvath puts it, it's the momentary giggle, and then you want another giggle. It's not about actually learning anything. It's about getting a momentary experience to feel as though you've learned something. The lesson from his binge-watching study is that if you want to remember the things you watch and read, space them out. I used to get irritated in school when an English class syllabus would have us read only 3 chapters a week. But there was a good reason for that. Memories get reinforced the more you recall them, Horvath says. If you read a book all in one stretch, on an airplane, say, you're just holding the story in your working memory that whole time. You're never actually reaccessing it, he says. Sina says that often when we read, there's a false feeling of fluency. The information is flowing in, we're understanding it. It seems like it is smoothly collating itself into a binder to be slotted into the shelves of our brain. But it actually doesn't stick unless you put effort into it and concentrate and engage in certain strategies that will help you remember. People might do that when they study or read something for work, but it seems unlikely that in their leisure time they're going to take notes on Gilmore Girls to quiz themselves later. You could be seeing and hearing, but you might not be noticing and listening, Sana says, which is, I think, most of the time what we do. Still, not all memories that wander are lost. Some of them may just be lurking, inaccessible until the right cue pops them back up. Perhaps a pre-episode, previously on Gilmore Girls, recap, or a conversation with a friend about a book you've both read. Memory is all associations, essentially, Sana says. That may explain why Paul and others remember the context in which they read a book without remembering its content. Paul has kept a book of books, or Bob, since she was in high school, an analog form of externalized memory in which she writes down every book she reads. Bob offers immediate access to where I've been psychologically and geographically at any given moment in my life, she explains in My Life with Bob, a book she wrote about her book of books. Each entry conjures a memory that may have otherwise gotten lost or blurred with time. In a piece for The New Yorker called The Curse of Reading and Forgetting, Ian Crouch writes, "Reading has many facets, one of which might be the rather indescribable and naturally fleeting mix of thought and emotion and sensory manipulations that happen in the moment and then fade. How much of reading, then, is just a kind of narcissism, a marker of who you were and what you were thinking when you encountered a text? To me, it doesn't seem like narcissism to remember life's seasons by the art that filled them, the spring of romance novels, the winter of true crimes. But it's true enough that if you consume culture in hopes of building a mental library that can be referred to at any time, you're likely to be disappointed. Books, shows, movies, and songs aren't files we upload to our brains. They're part of the tapestry of life, woven in with everything else. From a distance, it may become harder to see a single thread clearly, but it's still in there. It'd be really cool if memories were just clean information that comes in and now you have a memory for that fact, Horvath says. But in truth, all memories are everything. This was originally published in TheAtlantic.com. We're on the health and science page now. Discovery of a new organ. A vast network of fluid-filled channels that surrounds muscles and lines the digestive, respiratory, and urinary tracts may be a previously undetected human organ known as the interstitium, says scientists at New York University Langone School of Medicine. The researchers believe that this newly found structure, which appears to be an open, fluid-filled highway, serves as an internal shock absorber for other organs, and also plays a major role in the immune system. Interstitial fluid is the source of lymph, which dispatches white blood cells to fight infections. The interstitium could help explain how cancer cells spread throughout the body. Once they get in, it's like they're on a water slide, the study's co-author Neil Thies tells NewScientist.com. We have a new window on the mechanism of tumor spread. The interstitium holds about 20% of all the fluid in the human body, but it has evaded detection until now since tissue samples are typically dehydrated before being examined under a microscope. More research is needed to understand its role and determine whether it is indeed a distinct organ. Either way, Thies says, this discovery may lead to a significant reassessment of anatomy affecting every organ of the body. Ancient Amazon settlements. Long before the arrival of Europeans, up to 1 million people thrived in large, complex villages buried deep within the Amazon rainforest. A team of archaeologists found 81 ancient settlements in the upper Tapajos Basin, along Brazil's border with Bolivia. NationalGeographic.com reports, the settlements, which are roughly 500 to 750 years old, challenge long-standing views of the Amazon as a pristine wilderness. There is a common misconception that the Amazon is an untouched landscape, home to scattered nomadic communities, says study author Jonas Gregorio de Sousa. But that is not the case. We have found that some populations away from the major rivers are much larger than previously thought, and these people had an impact on the environment which we can still find today. Satellite images reveal dozens of geoglyphs, or geometric-shaped trenches, carved into the landscape. Ground surveys revealed abandoned stone tools, broken ceramics, buried trash, and terra preta, a type of charcoal-enriched, fertile soil made by ancient Amazonian civilizations. And we are on the Talking Points page. Parkland survivors, conservatives hit back. The survivors of the Parkland, Florida school shooting are still under attack, said Laurie Roberts in the Arizona Republic. Rather than engage with the young activist impassioned call for tighter gun control laws, conservatives, panicked by their eloquence, have showered them with personal smears, vitriol, and ad hominem attacks. Fox News host Laura Ingraham last week mocked Parkland student David Hogg for being rejected by four colleges despite his 4.2 GPA. Hogg then called for advertisers to boycott her show, and at least 19 companies obliged, forcing the right-wing provocateur to apologize and take a week's vacation. The attacks on the Parkland kids began with far-right conspiracy theorists, said Jeet Heer in NewRepublic.com, and then spread to mainstream conservatives. Some falsely claimed Hogg wasn't even at school during the Valentine's Day shooting, and that he and his fellow activists are actually actors hired by liberal adults. Emma Gonzalez, another activist Parkland survivor, was sneeringly described by a Republican candidate for the Maine State House as a, quote, skinhead lesbian. When you choose to enter the public arena, no one is above criticism, said Joseph Wolfson in TheFederalist.com. In his simplistic anti-gun campaign, Hogg has described the National Rifle Association as child murderers, and called Republicans who disagree with him sick blankers with blood on their hands. Throwing out insults and smears is Hogg's prerogative, but liberals can't complain when this bully receives a little back. The media and gun control activists are using Hogg as their sword and their shield, said David French in NationalReview.com. They egg him on to say vicious, cruel, and often false things about gun rights advocates, and then claim conservatives who respond are attacking the Parkland kids. These teens are powerful only because they're doing the work of powerful adults. Actually, the Parkland teens are winning the culture war, said Benjamin Hart in NYMag.com. Their passion and organizing ability has supercharged the gun reform movement. Polls show large majorities of Americans support their stated goals of universal background checks and banning assault-style weapons and large-capacity magazines. The, quote, gunshine state of Florida has adopted several new restrictions on firearms. Walmart and other stores are limiting their gun sales. As the saying goes, when you're personally attacking the survivors of a school shooting, you're losing. Census, a question of citizenship. How many people live in the United States of America? That shouldn't be a political question, said Jill Filipovich in CNN.com. But the Trump administration has turned the U.S. Census into a political football. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross announced last week that the next countrywide population survey in 2020 will ask residents if they are U.S. citizens. This question hasn't been on the census since 1950. For good reason. The Constitution requires a count of all residents, and a citizenship question will spook many illegal and legal immigrants into not taking part in the census, over fears ICE agents will come to drag them away. Those fears would create a vast undercount in immigrant-heavy areas. Since the census is used to determine how many House seats each state has and how to allocate $675 billion in federal funding, those areas would suffer significantly. This is just another way for Trump to punish blue states and cities, said the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger in an editorial. At least 17 states and 7 cities are suing, and the courts must block the president's census sabotage. There is nothing wrong with asking about citizenship, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. Canada, Australia, and other U.S. allies do it. The Census Bureau has continued to ask about citizenship on smaller-scale community surveys, ones that still involve millions of people, in the years since 1950. Besides, if people don't respond to the census, workers visit their house or ask their neighbors who lives there. So asking about citizenship is not likely to produce inaccurate data. Why should illegal immigrants have fair representation in Congress, asked Jonathan Tobin in NationalReview.com. That notion is inherently fraudulent. Once again, the left is trying to blur the distinction between citizens and non-citizens. It's the rights agenda that's the problem, said Jonathan Blitzer in The New Yorker. The census added the citizenship question at the suggestion of Justice Department official John Gore, who has been involved in Republican redistricting efforts in several states and in efforts to pass voter ID laws designed to reduce voting by blacks and Hispanics. That agenda has been wholeheartedly embraced by President Trump, who nonsensically insists that 4 million undocumented immigrants voted for Hillary Clinton. Why change a census policy that's been in place since 1950? The administration's motives are utterly transparent. And we'll round out the show with some shorter notes. Let's see. Donations to the National Rifle Association's PAC spiked after 17 people were killed in the Valentine's Day mass shooting in Parkland, Florida. The NRA's political arm, the Political Victory Fund, raised roughly $779,000 in February, compared with nearly $250,000 in January, according to Federal Election Commission filings. A taxpayer's chances of being audited by the IRS have plunged due to budget cuts and staff reductions at the agency mandated by the Republican-controlled Congress. In the fiscal year ending September 30th, the IRS audited just 1 in 160 individual returns, down from 1 in 90 in 2011. Households making $1 million or more were scrutinized 4.37% of the time, down from 12.48% in 2011. The Russian ambassador to the U.S. is so frustrated by senior U.S. lawmakers and government officials refusing to meet him that he has sent a letter to Senator Orrin Hatch asking for help. Anatoly Antonov listed 20 top U.S. elected and administration officials that have refused or ignored his requests for meetings, including White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, Vice President Mike Pence, House Speaker Paul Ryan, and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Just 32% of employed adults report having more take-home pay because of the tax cut. According to a CNBC poll, more than half say they see no change in their paychecks, and 16% are unsure. On the poll watch, 68% of Americans say teachers in their communities are underpaid. 21% think they are paid about right. Just 5% think that they're paid too much. And finishing out with a quote from the musician Questlove, decide who you're not before you decide who you are. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.